Good afternoon, and thank you all for holding. Your lines have been placed on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer portion of today's conference. I would like to remind all parties the call is now being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Britt Lundgren. Thank you. You may begin.
Hi. Thank you all for joining us. My name is Britt Lundgren. I co-organized the Data Science Seminar Series with Lita Benenson. I'm a AAAS fellow here in the Division of Undergraduate Education, which is part of the Education and Human Resources Directorate at NSF. I can just say a couple words about the Data Science Seminar Series, which we have about six or seven different meetings of per year. The Data Science Seminar Series brings in data science leaders from academia, government, and industry to discuss provocative topics related to big data and machine learning. I'm excited to be hosting this talk, which I believe is our first seminar series in the realm of education. It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Dr. Ed Bennett, who's the Senior Director at the Education Advisory Board, which is a D.C.-based best practices firm that advises more than 1,000 colleges and universities across North America and Europe. You can correct me if that's wrong.
Just one in Europe, actually.
Okay. Dr. Bennett comes to the education sector from the field of evolutionary biology, in which he holds a PhD from Duke University. His current research focuses on the use of data analytics to transform academic advising. Dr. Bennett recently led research to produce the best practices report called Hardwiring Student Success, which profiled 16 case studies from exemplar institutions of higher ed that invest in data-driven early warning strategies to identify students for proactive follow-up from support services. Dr. Bennett's latest work on data-driven approaches to student retention, which he'll be speaking about today, was recently highlighted in Inside Higher Ed. Following Dr. Bennett's talk, we'll invite those of you who are attending both in person and on the web to participate in a fireside chat, metaphorically, which will be moderated by Dr. Eamon Kelly, the Deputy Assistant Director and Senior Advisor in the NSF's Education and Human Rights, or Human Rights, Human Resources Directorate. I always know I'm going to say that. Okay, at this time, I'll hand things over to Dr. Bennett.
Thanks. Hi, welcome. Glad to be here. So this conversation kind of came about because Britt and I got connected to just chat a little bit about student success writ large and the issues that we're taking on over at EAB. EAB is part of the advisory board company, which if you are a D.C. native person who lived here for any amount of time, probably have heard of somewhere along the way. We started off as a healthcare best practices firm and have had built out an education practice really over the last 9 years. I was fortunate enough to be employee number 8 in the education practice after finishing grad school and not seeing much of a job market in front of me for a theorist in evolutionary biology in a time period that was in the 1970s. It was going to be a hard road to hoe, so I went corporate. But here I am back at the NSF, I guess, which is really fun. I've spent the last seven, eight years, really, basically since the beginning of time at EAB, working on student success. What I found is I learned quite a bit about how good I had it in my educational career. So I've never quite talked in front of an audience like this. I was trying to figure out how to start. And one of the things I realized is you may not have actually a sense of the scope of the problem. So if everybody would raise their hand in the air really quickly. Go ahead, everybody do it. If you went to undergrad outside the U.S., put your hand up. Okay. If you're going to put your hands down as we go. If everybody in with their hand in the air went to undergrad in the U.S. Okay, put your hand down if you went to a big public flagship e-school. Put it down if you did. Put your hand down if you went to an Ivy League or an Ivy Peer or a liberal arts college or any kind of prestigious private. Okay, everybody who's left is basically the majority of the students in the U.S. So the sort of schools that we went to, the mass majority of us, and I went to Duke twice, are not the sort of schools that we'll be talking about today. They also are basically irrelevant when you talk about degree production in the U.S. The vast majority of schools are directional Midwestern State University, Wright State, you know, or Grand Valley State, or whoever it might be, the University of Central Oklahoma. These are the schools we're talking about right now. The graduation rates at the sort of schools that the majority of the room went to, most students will graduate. Most students will graduate in 4 years. And when I say most, I mean 90% is typical. You look at, you know, a Carnegie Mellon or a Wake Forest or the University of Michigan, you're easily talking about 9 out of 10 students who start there will finish there, and most of them will finish within 4 years. That is, again, a complete aberration for the rest of the universe. So nationally speaking, the 6-year graduation rate for first-time full-time students, students who start at an institution full-time, meaning they're taking 12 credits, and finish at that same institution within 6 years, is 53%. Yeah, it's not good, right? So if you, and that doesn't actually really even capture what we're really doing, because if you ever, if you started college not full-time, you started part-time, you don't get counted that statistic. And if you ever transferred, anybody transfer from undergrad? Yeah, you never graduated, sorry,
yeah,
according to the federal government.
I left 10.2.
Federal government says if you didn't finish where you started, you don't count.
Yep.
So if you ever transfer somewhere, you also aren't counted in statistics. So basically, we're only capturing about 60% of the students in higher ed, even with those metrics. And remember, we're talking about 6-year graduation rate, not even 4-year rate. Really good state flagship schools don't graduate half their students in 4 years. Like, we're talking about the Michigans, UNCs, and Berkeleys of the world. They're not getting students out in 4. They're getting out in 4.5 or 5 because their programs are more than 120 credits, or they couldn't get some class, or huge bureaucracy, or something went wrong, whatever it might be, right? That adds cost. So this is a big issue. It's actually capturing a lot of national attention right now, and it's an issue that our members, we call our clients members because we're like that, need to pay a lot more attention to now for a variety of reasons. So it used to be one of these things where, why do we want to improve? We want to improve because it's the right thing to do. Students are coming to us. We're an educational institution. We need to graduate. Now there's all kinds of pressures from state legislatures, from the federal government, from parents. People are concerned about $1 trillion in student debt. Dirty secret, it's mostly master's degrees. But for the individual students who are taking out 20 or 30K in loans and not finishing, that's a meaningful amount for them. So it's really out there. Students are complaining that they're underemployed when they graduate. Some of them are voluntarily baristas as they're trying to write the Great American Novel. Most of them are involuntarily baristas as they're trying to find an actual job. And really about 1/3 of people say that their college experience was worth it, so to speak. So we are an industry in crisis. At the same time, you've got this massive demographic shift going on, where the sort of student who came to college for really since World War II is no longer the sort of student who went to college because those people stopped having babies. Now, if you look at where all the population growth is in the U.S., it's in the lower income brackets, below 60K for families and below 30K really is where you see a lot of the growth. These students are definitionally coming from backgrounds in which they have less financial resources. They're more susceptible to strain, perturbations. Somebody loses a job or something goes wrong, you're out of school. Because the thing that you cut from your budget is education instead of, you know, food. The other thing is that these students are disproportionately coming from lousier high schools. And that shows up in their SAT scores. SAT is a terrible measure of intelligence, but it is a good measure of preparation. So are you prepared for college? Not your raw ability to succeed, but are you ready for this? And there's a 262-point difference on average between the top and the bottom income brackets. So now you have a situation where the students who are now entering higher ed are less well-prepared, less financially well-off, and they're more likely to be first-gen. They're more likely to be different in kind in many different ways from what schools are used to dealing with.
You could emphasize those 262 points slightly differently. It looks like the scale of 1600
is 400 to 1600. Fair enough. Yeah. Yeah, so it's even actually a bigger difference. Good point. Nobody's ever pointed that out, but now, in the higher ed artists, literally nobody's ever pointed that out. We're already seeing this change, so there's sort of, while this is all going on, there are now fewer students in many areas of the country, especially the Rust Belt, the Northeast. If you are in Maine right now, don't take a job in Maine. They are freaking out. They have no students. Yeah. Basically, Southern Florida, Texas, California's got plenty of students. Everybody's poaching from California. Anywhere else in the country is either flat or actually declining in their student populations, which for an industry that's geared for growth is a huge problem. So what's happening is that you combine the demographic shift with the fact that now the best schools are still desirable locations and they're kind of eating everybody else's lunch. You see this shift occurring in the SAT scores. publics and privates that have graduation rates above 80% have been getting better students based on their SAT scores for the last 10 years. Everybody else is getting worse. So this trend's already being felt. Projections are this will continue, probably till 2022, maybe 2025, depending on where you want to go live. So that's the background situation. Why are we talking about healthcare? Well, there is another industry that is facing a rising demand with a fixed capacity for care, and it is healthcare. So, and which is not to say that healthcare is in any way a model industry. There's been a lot of ink spilled about everything that's wrong with it. We won't get into that. But this is their basic problem. So you've got an aging demography as baby boomers enter retirement and eventually old age. They put a greater demand on the system, yet we have a fixed amount of MDs. Well, relatively fixed. Growing a little bit, but basically we're not increasing our production of doctors, nor should we, because we want the best of the best. Also, it takes 7 years to make a doctor if you consider the 4 years of medical school plus 3 years of residency. So it's hard to do. So this shift is occurring. How do we get ready for it? There are some creepy similarities with the way that care is provided to students in higher ed and care is traditionally provided to us as human beings in the American medical system. Providers are optimized for throughput, not outcomes. This is a really important point. If you get sick and you go to the doctor, they get paid. You go back with the same illness, they get paid again and again and again. It's the same sort of thing. So they're optimized to fill up their appointment calendar, but not necessarily to fill up their panel of patients. In fact, they'd be very happy with one patient if you were there filling up every single appointment. The same sort of thing in higher ed. To the extent that there is ever accountability, it's usually based around, like, how many advising appointments are you, how many students are you seeing? It's throughput optimized. Care depends on periodic in-person contact. You just got to go to the doctor. You've got to go to an advisor. The recipient is not trusted to care for themselves. Student self-advisement is a dirty word in higher ed. They might get it wrong. Problems are just reactively, not proactively. This is huge. We are not heading off student success problems at the pass. They're manifesting. I have a slide on that in a moment. The same thing is true with healthcare. You wait to get sick and then you go to the doctor. You don't do preventative medicine necessarily. That's beginning to change, obviously. Interactions can be transactional. Data sharing is abysmal. There's no record sharing in higher ed within the same campus. I mean between people that sit next to each other, right? Part of that's because they don't keep electronic records. Another part of it is they don't lack the systems. Salesforce is coming into higher ed and actually kind of revolutionary, and we're doing the same thing as well with our technologies. I won't get through the rest of it, but how has healthcare been dealing with their demographic shift? So if there's a lesson we can learn from this, what are we learning? Does anybody actually know what population health management is before I start to, okay. I know, like, this much. I spent a couple weeks last summer, like, getting really scrubbed in on it. I got to feel like an academic again for a little bit. It was fun. This is how they're dealing with their capacity problem. So they're shifting the way that they get compensated. No longer just for the transactions, but now they're getting compensated based on the number of, and this is a new term, covered lives. So how many lives does this hospital intersect? How many lives does this primary care physician intersect? The more you have, the more you get paid. So now you're optimized not for filling up your appointment book, but for filling up your essentially Rolodex of patients. The more you can handle and maintain outcomes, the better you are. Well, how do you maintain outcomes if you're going to provide really in aggregate less total care to each person? And the trick is you use some analytics and then some other things. Let me walk you through what they're doing. They divide the world. I mean, there's a lot of ways to do this, but basically most systems divide the world into three kinds of patients. They call it rising and low risk. Rising is medium, but there's a distinction there that's important. At each level, they deal with the patients in different ways. Differentiated care. So for the highest risk patients, these people are real sick. They're in and out of hospitals on a regular basis. We want to keep them out of the hospital whenever possible. And the way you do that is you keep them at home and you surround them with what's called a care team of relatively inexpensive care providers, pharmacists, social worker, physical therapists, the patient's family. They are networked together into a system that is quarterbacked by an experienced nurse or a physician. That physician can extend their influence to a large number of patients using these agents that they have out in the field, essentially, with technology. The lowest risk patients, which is the vast majority of us, the idea is to keep us out of the system entirely. Do you need an annual physical if there's something wrong with you? I went for one, actually, recently. It lasted 6 minutes. I timed it. It was 6 minutes. They went in, they poked me a couple times, they drew some blood, and I was out the door. There's nothing wrong with me. I didn't need to be there. In fact, it was the first anal physical I had in 5 years. Don't even ask the last time I went to the dentist. But so the lowest risk patients, the shift here is towards WebMD, towards scalable e-medicine, and preventative measures. So we are, at least the EAB, incentivized by our insurance company to do things like walk upstairs instead of taking the elevator. Literally, there's incentives for this. They gave us Fitbits and things. But this is all coming from our insurance company, and I would rather that we don't present and, you know, they have to reimburse for that. They just want to take our money and then not pay. Well, this is all part of the system, right? Keep us out of it. Rising risk is the most interesting part of the population. These are folks who have something wrong with them, but not today. So diabetics fall into this category. You have an identifiable condition. Something will go wrong with you in the future. But if we can catch it early, we can keep you from escalating to the top of the pyramid, where you become a real problem for the system and yourself. This is the group which has a massive amount of data analytics applied to it. So if you hear about biodata being used for all kinds of fancy ways in hospitals, chances are it's in this tier. So this is where close monitoring, a lot of analytics, and essentially a lot of close patient touches are occurring. Hospitals will tell you it's really easy to identify high risk and it's really easy to identify low risk. It's this middle group that is where they think they're going to make their money. The few hospitals that have really put this in place, and this is a decades-long shift that's going to be occurring, reported pretty good results as far as reducing admit rates to emergency departments and just general overall cost of care for patients. This is still very much emerging. And there are few health systems that have completely dove in. There are a few that are dabbling with this, but it's moving towards it. Everybody thinks it's the right idea. Everybody's kind of afraid to be the first mover. So we looked at this all summer. And by the way, I just gave you a totally skim. There's textbooks and textbooks and textbooks written about this, and I've missed some very important points, I'm sure. However, this is what we walked away with this summer when we looked at it, because we weren't looking to change a hospital. We were looking to change universities. And we wanted to pull out the pieces that thought were important for schools, recognizing that there's a big difference between someone not graduating and someone dying, right? And the type of care that you're providing is also very different. So we were just trying to pull out the elements that we thought could be useful for helping universities deal with their scaling problem. And we think there's four things you need. One is you need world-class analytics. You need to understand who is at risk. You need to be able to build the pyramid. Two, you need to be able to coordinate care. So you need to have that care team and actually network them together. Three, you need to have different things you're doing for different levels. You need to have your differentiated care streams defined. And four, you need ownership and accountability. With one exception, none of these things exist at universities. So we have a little joke in the advisory board, which is hospitals are about 5 years behind industry and innovation. And we've gotten to the education sector, we realized very quickly, universities are 10 years behind hospitals. There's no reason to innovate, right? 50 years behind.
Particularly universities.
Yeah, I mean, they don't have much money. They're not attracting the best talent to run the place. Schools like Arizona State are way ahead of the curve. Georgia State, school we work with, love those guys. But the run-of-the-mill university out there doesn't have much motivation to change in this arena or much of the ability to change. Plus, universities are fundamentally like maybe the federal government and the Catholic Church are the only two organizations in the world that move more slowly than a university when it comes to change. They're built for stasis. So we haven't been able to do things like putting out kind of
those. ASU, in the basic business model, doesn't see, so
yeah.
They need those.
Right? Oh, yeah.
They cannot survive if they don't keep going to the
student. And you've got a four-campus university with 60,000 undergraduates, not even counting the another probably 150,000 to 200,000 graduate students. It's a crazy place. You cannot run that place without data in it, without great record keeping, and without some really strong leadership. Very few schools are Arizona State in that regard. Yeah. The University of Central Florida is moving in that direction. So we have been talking to our members, and remember, we provide both research, which I would describe in corporate sense, maybe not the kind of research you guys do, but this is the kind of research we do, coupled with technology to enable this action, and also consulting because, again, they don't know how to do some of this change management. We bring the ideas based on the work we've done. We work with roughly 200 schools, and we're trying to put this model in place at those 200 schools. I'm going to walk you through what we're doing with it. The lesson for the data analytics group is what people are quickly realizing in higher ed, and this is the key takeaway. For the last 5 years, people have been investing right here in this box, we're going to figure out who's at risk. And they've been putting all their eggs there. And there are some companies out there that are making some great, great money right now with really fancy pants predictive modeling systems. Nobody knows what to do with that information. You're at risk. Now what do I do? So steps 2 through 4 are actually maybe the most important. And so we're a little bit ahead of the curve, and that's where we would bring in our consulting arm a little bit. But let me walk you through each of these things. And I'm just going to call it defining a differentiated care strategy. We truly have a predictive model. I threw this slide in here really as red meat for you. Some kind of cool insights that we have from looking at data at all these schools. Everybody knows that students who fail courses are doing something bad. What we found is that actually students who get C's in courses, especially intro foundational courses, are also in big time trouble. Look at what you got here. So this is a real bio major at a real state flagship university. These are the graduation rates for students in biology, or bio majors graduating in biology based on their introductory course grades. And for calc, A, B, C doesn't matter, just don't fail it. For pre-calc, getting a C is pretty much as bad as a D or F. And in intro to bio, even a B isn't great. So there's some courses that present kind of a fingerprint. Students are passing, but they're not actually getting what they need out of that course, or there's some indication of danger ahead. This is especially true in sequence majors, but pretty much every major university has at least one or two courses that are like this, even the liberal arts. Oftentimes it's the gen ed courses in liberal arts. And sometimes there's weird linkages like math and music or history and everything. I don't know why, but history shows up again and again. What we found is there's kind of this curve. This is idealized, obviously, but we have our three risk categories that we're defining using academic data. Why are we using this data? Well, as we begin to extract information from universities, we realize there's only one data source of any use for doing predictive modeling, and it is the student transcripts. You've got it going back 10 years or more. You've got it for every single student. You're collecting it for everybody. It's relatively clean. It's not clean at all, but it's relatively clean, and it's relatively easy to get versus, oh, I've got swipe cards over here and some surveys over here, this, that, the other thing. That's incredibly expensive for schools to pull together. So we've invested almost all of our eggs here, in addition to some student biodemographic data, which is kept in the same records. We will be adding in financial records as we go, as we learn more about it. But that's the mess of itself. Anyway, we found there's sort of three tiers, and basically the way that we've been talking about it with schools is you're already putting a lot of effort really into the high risk and the low risk. High risk because they're obvious. You don't need a model to tell you who's high risk. And low risk because they're actually asking for it. They're all of you. Come in, I want a double major, I want a triple major, I want to study abroad over here, I want to do this, that, the other thing. They're the ones who are sucking up a lot of the advisor's time because they're actually there having non-required conversations. And frankly, that's who the faculty members and the academic advisors want to talk to. These are our best students. Like, of course I want to talk to this person. So this is our approach to analytics. It's not terribly sophisticated, but it is something that is good for with the approach we're trying to take, where we're really just trying to get to three levels. So horseshoes and hand grenades, we've got it right here. Our differentiated care strategy is a little bit different than healthcare. So we decided to build not a pyramid, but kind of maybe a Mayan pyramid, the kind of steps. For every student, you're going to get preventative measures put in place. And oftentimes, if you don't have a technological basis, we are building that out as well. But the idea is that we want to enable, whenever possible, students to direct themselves or be directed without even knowing they're being directed. More on that in a moment, nudge principles, to do the right thing. For the moderate and high-risk students, we're adding in a layer of proactive intervention. Schools are actually quite terrible about proactively reaching out to students who have obvious warning signs. You can't do it for everyone because it comes crazy expensive to do, but you can do it for some students, and it's these two categories that we're most interested in. And then for the highest-risk students, high-touch care. Study after study has proven if you can coach a high-risk student, if you can surround them with care, if you touch base with them weekly, they do better than their peers. Again, though, crazy expensive to do. Hard to get somebody who's being paid $30K a year to do that day in and day out with this cohort of students that need a lot of help. So this is our approach. I'm going to walk you through each of these levels, 1, 2, 3. As we go, you can kind of see how it's built out. Stop at any point if you have questions, by the way.
But is the bottom premise on the notion that everybody should get through?
I was waiting for that. So we are premised on the notion that everyone should get through. Who can? Obviously, there are some students who don't, quote-unquote, belong in college, but the sort of old notion of if they dropped out, they didn't belong here in the first place is demonstrably not true for most of these schools. There are students who are legitimately not ready for college when they show up, either emotionally or academically or financially. They're just not ready. It's a relatively small group, I would say. Our data shows that it can't be more than 20% of students at even the worst schools. A bigger chunk of students that are leaving, it's either death by a thousand cuts, or it's an extrinsic factor that has not the student's fault, or actually something negligent the school did. So there's a gray area there. But we run into curmudgeonly faculty members everywhere that throw that at us still.
Right. So, yeah. And I'm just wondering whether there's a price point. Right?
Yeah.
So all the schools want these butts and chairs. Mm-hmm. Right? They have, whether they say it or not, they have some model for staying open.
Yeah.
Particularly state schools now, given that the states have basically wiped out their funding
for yeah.
the IRA. Right? So they figure that out, whether they're articulating it or
yeah.
not. So keeping everybody in a chair for longer
yeah.
is in the school's best interest, fiscally. Whether you can keep them for long enough to graduate or not.
It's interesting because that's the sort of approach that if universities run by MBAs, that's what would happen. We would keep our customers forever, which in a way they're trying to do with advanced degrees. But well, yes and no, because at many schools, the reason you're taking 6 years is because you've dropped down to part-time and you're paying per credit. So there is, with the fees aside, the actual gain for those students. Also, upper division students are more expensive to teach than lower division students because they take smaller classes. So that's not actually, the economics of that don't work out perfectly when you look into it, and we have extensively. The other thing is that schools are actually, to their credit, unwilling to go there. They want enrollment, and they see this as an enrollment play.
Michael Crow.
I know, but he's Michael Crow, right? But most schools are not willing to take that step of, like, we're actually just trying to suck as much money out of the student for as long as we can keep them. They're still focused on the end goal of, we're supposed to graduate the kid. Now, we'll benefit
yeah.
if we can keep them around, but we're not going to drag it out for longer than it would be. So. Also, nobody believes that they're going to do 100% graduation rate, not even Harvard, because they're going to have someone who has transfers out or has a mental health breakdown of some sort and can't finish or whatever it might be. But most schools would love to be at 80% for 6 years. So let me walk you through all three of these. We'll start with the lowest risk, behavioral nudges. The things that schools want to be doing here is spend the least amount of time and effort to get students to do the right things. And there have been some really cool initiatives that are kind of nudgy in a way, and I'll walk you through just three very briefly. One is the University of Hawaii invention called 15 to Finish. Anybody heard of this? Yeah, a couple people? Yeah. It's a really neat thing. So what they found in Hawaii was that the majority of their full-time students were taking 12 credits in their first term. And that became normal because it was what you were doing in your first term. Why are you doing this? Well, 12 is what the minimum for full-time, which they're going to be 12, obviously. Ease into this college thing. Now it becomes a habit. Students not doing the math and realizing that 12 times 8 semesters doesn't equal 120, which is what they would need to graduate, were starting off on the wrong foot and as a result extending their career by a full year. Hawaii realized that this wasn't a student problem necessarily, this was an awareness problem. So they launched a PR campaign. I mean, it's YouTube videos and print advertising, stuff on the radio targeting the parents. And there's some that are targeted students, but they're essentially laying out the math. If you take an extra year to graduate, one, it costs you $10,000 more. Two, your opportunity cost of taking an extra year to graduate is less. These pithy little 2 to 3 minute videos, they're really cool, have actually completely changed behavior in their first year students. So now they're up about 16% on the students taking 15 instead of 12. And they continue to see some gains there. This is a movement that's shaping the nation right now. Probably about 10% of schools have something like this in place, and everybody else is thinking about it. This is distinct, by the way, from if you were reading IHCD yesterday, the graduation guarantees from SUNY Buffalo, which we don't believe is necessarily a best practice. Here's another example, Cleveland State multi-term registration. Cleveland State, it's your typical urban serving public, lots of part-time students, lots of students who are kind of opting in and out of school. What they found was actually students were not continuing from fall to spring in great numbers, more than you would expect. And this could be solved with a bit of a hack. Get the students to register for both fall and spring at the same time, and now there's a mental default that I'm coming back to school for the spring semester, I'm already registered. And all they had to do was just get in and quite literally hack the registration system to put two screens up at once. Instant 3% increase in fall to spring retention just from doing that. And then there's James Madison, a school that does not really have a student success problem, but you know, nevertheless, it's invested in a massive student success center. If you ever get to go out to JMU and see this thing, it is a converted hospital. It's 220,000 square feet, five stories, in the middle of campus. You can't build this thing for your most school. They've dumped $77 million into it. Every service is co-located in it. And I went and visited. Shocked. I mean, it was jam-packed with students. It was the best student center I'd ever seen, really. And some of the secrets behind it, they really did some great design thinking to figure out how to get students to engage with the building. One thing, they put some essential services on the fifth floor, like the registrar. You have to go through the rest of the building to get there. Two, they figured out the linchpin in the operation was actually going to be a Dunkin' Donuts. They put that on the first floor right outside this sort of social study area with carrels just that high. So it's private, but you can't avoid talking to your neighbors, really, so it's kind of semi-private. And I interviewed a student very briefly. She said, yeah, I like this place because it's quieter than the first floor of the library, but louder than the second floor of the library. This is kind of where I want to be. But there's some really interesting things that are going on inside the building if you start to peel away the onion. I talked to another student. She was a sophomore. And I said, well, what have you used in this building besides, you know, the Dunkin' Donuts? Well, I'm going to use that thing over there in a little bit. She was pointing to the Academic Support Center, which is directly in front of her. So imagine a big open area with lots of couches and desks and things like that and thousands of students, and this is right in front of their face. Well, what do you do? Well, I'm writing the paper, and I'll go in, and they'll read it and offer me feedback. It's great. Oh, okay. Did you use that last year before the building was open? I didn't even know that existed. So co-location of services is an interesting hack. You put the things that you want students to engage with where the students are, and they'll just naturally start using them. The best example, the data that we have here, is for the mental health center, which, by the way, is directly next to the Dunkin' Donuts. And it's experiencing a 20% increase in foot traffic from being in this building versus where they were before, which is this little house in the middle of campus that everybody knew what you were going into. So the idea here, you don't have a hospital, you don't have $77 million lying around, but you can begin to co-locate services in an interesting way. On campus, especially if you're trying to do something with that massive library that's no longer filled with books and are now becoming these sort of like big academic support centers in a lot of places. So that's a little risk. I want to talk a little bit about our rising risk populations and why we're so interested in higher ed. A little bit of history. Everybody knows that all the students who drop out of higher ed drop out in the first year. That's like everybody gets it. It's not true. Half the students who leave their school in the first year. It's a little bit more private. It's actually quite a bit less at public, so about 40%. Well, that means definitionally that 50 to 60% of your students are leaving after the first year. But nobody pays any attention to these students because, one, the literature has basically ignored them. Because most of the literature was written by people at Syracuse and Vanderbilt and the University of South Carolina. No, it's true. Like those three schools. We actually do have a first-year retention problem and not so much later on. That's going a little bit aside. So they basically ignored. The other thing is that the federal metric that everybody is graded against is first-time, full-time retention. That means retention to the second year. After that, we don't care until you graduate. So sophomores are basically not counted, and if you're a real cynic, you know, we manage to the metrics, so don't care about those guys. What we found was, actually, there's a huge population here, and these students pay tuition. So if you're interested in doing the enrollment play here, you would be interested in this group. They've also cleared two important hurdles. One, they didn't blow up freshman year. They have above a 2.0 typically. So you don't have to remediate them academically. And two, they came back for sophomore year. They like you. They're not going to transfer somewhere else. They voted in. They've got a sweatshirt and everything for your campus. So why aren't they finishing? Well, one thing, we had to identify the population. So we just built this histogram. This is 750,000 students. And representing, I forget how many schools, we probably had about 50 schools to work with at this point. What you see here is four colors of bars, the histogram, so these are total aggregate of students. First year GPA, total students. This color right here is students who didn't come back for a second year. You can see it's just all over the board, right? Certainly the students below a 2.0 are disproportionately represented here for not coming back for the second year, but even some very good students not coming back. They're transferring somewhere else. They're going to graduate from college, just not from yours. The light colored bars are graduates. So here's where I'm going to blow your mind. Students who do it better in college are more likely to graduate. They're all on that. But then this blue group here are students who come back for a second year who don't finish. So they're that murky middle group that what's going on with these guys. And this group right here is really interesting schools because it's a kind of a huge chunk, and they tend to be localized between 2.0 and 3.0. And it can be, that little group can be like 20% of your student body, depending on some places. 84% return for a second year. That's a great retention rate, but 48% graduate. That's a bad graduation rate. So there's something going on with that group that we can look at. And this is the group we think is the death by a thousand cuts group. They don't have massive problems. They have a little problem. Something went wrong, or they had lots of little problems, and then finally they had the straw that breaks the camel's back. I will try to get more consulting metaphors into this presentation as I go. We did a little more analytics, and we had our version of analytics, and we looked at what was happening term over term GPA. We found some pretty clear trends. So there's 13 populations on here, broken down by your fate, gray bars being graduates and blue bars being dropouts, and the time of when your fate occurred. And then this was your term trend GPA. So for graduates, you got better academically on a whole as you progressed towards graduation. Actually, the faster you were going to graduate, the faster you got better. Then these were the students who didn't make it. So you kind of stay stable, and then you fall off. A couple of interesting things about this, you can see it coming from a mile away. This is an aggregate, not individual students are a lot more noisy. And after graduation, which usually happens at 2.0, wasn't catching anybody until the very last term, at least on average. So there's something going wrong with this population. It's spottable well in advance. It's probably not grades. Grades are probably an indicator or some underlying factor. But it's clear that there's a trend. So we kind of told a little story. What would this be like for a student? And this is not an atypical story. Starts off okay, finishes the first year with a 2.0, 2.5 GPA. Makes a little mistake. Doesn't realize you got to refile a FAFSA to get financial aid for the second year. This is about 10 to 15% of students. Don't get your financial aid. Now you got to pick up hours at work. You're going to stay in school. Creates conflict with coursework. Your performance goes down. Things are going worse for you. Now you're in academic distress, financial stress, and potentially emotional distress. This is when your school notices you. So now it's actually a high effort, high intervention turnaround. Intensive tutoring to improve your GPA. You're going to need some sort of assistance to clear a bursar hold and stay enrolled. And you may even need some mental health counseling. Or we could have caught you on the cheap earlier on if you just figured out you didn't refile your FAFSA and then got all over it yet. Why is this not happening? Well, everything that universities do is reactive in this regard. You could say that's reactive as well, but they don't really have the staff firepower to go after every student who isn't completing a form, registering for classes, or doing all the little things. They wait for the problem to manifest. And just like the diabetic who now has a problem with his feet or whatever, when they finally present at the emergency room, it's quite costly to fix the problem, if they can at all. So we developed a kind of a list of things that schools could look at, little things. And if you looked at all these little things, you would catch a lot of problems. And we actually have had some schools that have looked at just the most basic indicator of students dropping out, and that's, are you not registered for the next term? And just start calling. Why are you not registered? Well, I'm transferring out. Great, I won't call you again. Why are you not registered? Oh, I forgot. Well, go register. Or I have a bursar hold. I don't know what that is. Or I have some other problem. Well, they'll work it through. And schools like Middle Tennessee, which is another favorite of mine, have seen immediate 3% gains just from going after that sort of stuff. Basic stuff. The only reason they weren't doing it is that prior to Middle Tennessee hiring a bunch of people, they didn't have the capacity to make the phone calls. You're asking someone who is an academic advisor, feels like they are giving you advice, or even work with a faculty member to make hundreds of phone calls. Below their pay grade. They're not going to do it. There are some schools that have solved this, and they've solved it by using the students themselves. So they have student-staffed call centers. They're largely calling prospective students or donors. They turned these students around and faced them inward and said, you're going to call everybody who hasn't refiled their FAFSA that has to. We're going to call everybody who's not registered for the next term who's supposed to. Basic stuff. They get really tight scripts, and if they encounter a problem that they don't know the answer to, that's what they escalate. And it's working great at these schools. This is a relatively new practice, but for something so simple, this is what everybody's attaching to now. Oh, great, this is where we can get the capacity to finally do these things. And it was there all along. We're supposed to high risk. I'm mindful of time. I know there's supposed to be a fireside chat, and I've got a couple extra slides, but we'll get there. So high risk coaching, the answer here is really that you just have to be able to do it. And the only way schools are going to be able to do this is if they create what we're calling the coordinated care network, because we like to brand everything. But the idea here is that the advisor, the faculty member, the tutor, the financial aid office, the mental health office, any number of other support services around campus are horribly disconnected in most schools. They don't share notes. They don't even know who each other are. They certainly can't collaborate on a case. But if you get a CRM into place, that becomes more possible. But you're going to have to change a lot of processes. One school that's already doing this is Northeastern. And what they've been able to do is set up a person, her name's Sally, or Susan, Sally. She's in one of their colleges, behavioral and social sciences, I think. I got that wrong. But she handles just the highest risk cases. She has 150 students. They're either pre-identified as being provisional admits or probationary in some way, or they get a bunch of early alerts, or they're referred by other advisors. But these students need help. She works with them on a weekly or a biweekly basis. She acts as their concierge to the rest of campus. And she's rigged up her CRM to allow her to make referrals so that she knows when students have made it to where they're going, essentially. So just by increasing the amount of data flow, and I'm talking about notes, or simply check in, you know, the student we referred over here, did they make it? Great, I got a notification that they made it. Closing that loop. That sort of technology is still relatively non-installed in universities. But this is the sort of stuff that frontline folks get really excited about when you tell them, hey, we can finally do this. And it's basic stuff that's now becoming kind of commonplace in most other industries, and it's just now beginning to get to higher ed. It's also going to completely change the way they think about the world. All right, just a couple more slides, and then we can chat. One of the big things that's driving the change in healthcare is accountability and ownership. Now, ownership over your patients is something that's being redefined by this covered lives panel idea. Accountability has kind of always been in place. This is your patient. Take care of them. These things are completely absent in higher ed. No one owns student success at any level. And that's, you know, when you have a problem which everybody owns it and therefore no one owns it, this is one of those problems. That is beginning to change a little bit, where people are actually held somewhat accountable for this problem, which has been commonly felt. Here's your basic problem, and if you ever end up in academic administration at a university, this is like what you're gonna just beat your head against the wall again and again, because this sort of problem emerges. It used to be that student success was the responsibility of the VP of Student Affairs, because obviously these students don't like it here, so let's build a better climbing wall or something along those lines, and then suddenly they'll want to stay. So they had a piece of the pie. Then it became a provostial issue, so of course she hands it off to the VP of Undergraduate Studies, because it must be an academic problem, so now they've got some things they're doing. The academic deans, well, the faculty have to be involved even though they don't ever actually want to do anything. They also are responsible for a lot of academic advising. And then there's two new players. One is the VP of Student Success, which is a new role that's being created at a lot of schools. They've actually elevated to a cabinet-level issue, for real. Middle Tennessee has a guy named Rick Sluter, who's in the news quite a bit. Georgia State has Kim Rennick. But they're popping up. Probably about 10% of schools have a cabinet-level person with success in their title. And if it's not them, it might be this person. The VP of Enrollment Management has now got that in their portfolio. About 40% of them say that they own success. Not just responsible for getting students here, they got to keep them. Okay, now we've created a complete maze where now everybody's owning the problem, and you have the hypothetical student success office with all the pieces in place that would span across all these silos. You know what universities are really bad at? Spanning silos, right? So there are schools that are beginning to bundle these things together by hook or by crook. In some ways, one of my favorites is at Portland State, where one of the people that we know there has essentially did a land grab and bundled all these things together into the perfect office that he wanted to make. Other schools are just doing this via better processes. But it's largely a challenge that's still out there that schools haven't solved. Another problem occurs at the front line. So that's a very high level. What about the people working with students every single day? Well, the workhorse here is the academic advisor. This is a professional advisor. Most schools are now hiring people whose entire job is to advise students. Now, in the olden days, it was your faculty member, one of your faculty members was providing you advice, and they gave you some guidance on courses. But they weren't very good at it, so you went to the departmental secretary, and she actually knew the answer. Then all the students started asking her, so she said, this is actually now my job, and I want to get paid for that, and now I'm an academic advisor. And the professional advisor was born. And that became a profession and now has a national association and everything. But this is largely how that person thinks about their world. They do registration, course planning, and major guidance. And then now only recently have they begun to do some student success-y stuff. But they believe in their heart that this is what their job is, right? Sometimes they have specializations over here. You have something to say?
Well, as an academic advisor,
Kansas State? Because Nakata is there. So, yes, Kansas State is an exception to this by far. And there are some schools out there that have definitely changed the model, so I wasn't trying to offend you in any way. But this is more common than what you're describing. What you're describing is that, which is I care about students at the center, and I do some things, registration being one of them. But now I'm also becoming this more of this Swiss Army knife type role that is meant to be this concierge, which just sounds like what you were describing. But schools like Kansas State have been far and away the head of this for a while, innovating in this regard. This is a shift. I put this up on up on a big screen in November, and this was the one thing that everybody started taking their cameras out to take pictures of in Instagram immediately because it was capturing the problem that they were feeling. And these are mostly directors of advice. Like, I'm trying to get my people to move over to the right. I have a whole other run, which we don't have time for, about how accountability is showing up more and more. There are now people who are performance reviews that are tied to the retention rates of their cohorts, which I bet wasn't the case for you, but maybe it was. I don't know. Could have been. It was. No. But we've been able to identify six pathologies when it comes to ownership and student success at universities. And every school I show this slide to, I say, you don't have all six of these things wrong with you, but you don't have all six of these things solved either, not even the best. And, you know, I'll just walk you through real quick. There's a lack of senior leaders with clear ownership. The faculty really don't know what their role is. And they have a great heterogeneity of views and perspectives towards this. So about 20 to 30% of faculty really, really care about this issue, but they're not being activated to go after it. Advisors themselves, very fragmented at most schools. They've grown up in their own individual academic departments or colleges. They don't necessarily talk to each other. Some schools have been investing in first-year university colleges, and they don't have great handoffs with the academic units. It's balkanized. Nobody is actually assigned responsibility for the success of their cohort. They may be assigned responsibility for number of advising meetings they have or things along these lines, but actually half of professional advisors don't even do annual performance reviews. So it's hard to do that. Metrics, no one knows what to track. We have some metrics which update yearly, like graduation rate and first year retention, but you can't really manage on that. You know, we need stuff that updates day by day and week by week. So something like the number of students we have registered for the next term or the number of students that have a degree plan on file would be a good metric, but schools are only beginning to go in this direction. And it's very hard to reward people for good work. So incentivize folks to do the right thing here. You have to actually build it into their performance review, like do great, get promoted, or public praising, which is... The faculty are a real problem here. Because nowhere is this showing up in tenure, right? Maybe in your service component, maybe not. So the way that schools are beginning to get faculty members on board with this is they have the provost has the one thing that the faculty members really, really want, which is more faculty lines. So at schools like UMass Dartmouth, they've brokered a relationship by which they've given each academic unit a target to hit. Then they said, you guys can go ahead and come up with a plan to hit this target or not, your choice. But if you file a plan and you hit your target, you go to the front of the line for the open faculty lines next year. You might not get it, but you go to the front of the line, you'll be top consideration because you're already, one, you're playing ball, and two, you're improving the quality of your unit, so therefore you deserve to get bigger. Mm-hmm. And also because you increase your retention rate, you have more students that you might need an extra instructor. So this is only coming about now. If I was thinking about a big area where I want to spend a lot of my time, it would be finding the best ways to get accountability built in around this problem in higher ed while staying true to higher ed's ethos, mission, right? Because this is not a corporate structure, never should be. But there may be a couple things that could be learned from really people that have been doing this forever and ever. Won't even talk about this, but it's a nice backdrop. So that's largely what I had to say.
Hi there.
Hi. What do we do now?
No fire, no. We need some fire. Keep the whole fire burning.
So I want to just kick off a couple of questions.
Sure, that'd be great.
What about the sense of agency that a student has? So that first slide about $1 trillion and all of that, Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't I go to Coursera and pick up courses free? Like, why am I investing?
Mm-hmm.
What's the incentive to keep me going to an institution over time?
Yeah.
Or if I am a more mature student, I'm out there, I've already had a bachelor's degree, and I don't want to come back to the university because I can pick up a course in Python
mm-hmm.
on Coursera. So how does that kind of self-care model interact
with continuing an online education is really interesting. So if you think about a fully online model and you look at the University of Phoenix's of the world, their graduation rates, which I do not report very well, are quite bad. There has to be something about you being present to keep you invested in an institution. Not always, but if you're thinking about 4 years, if you're online, you're probably not full-time, so it's going to be more than 4 years. It's tough. If you're doing job retraining, you just want a course, or it's your own personal enrichment, that's where the MOOCs are really great, or the online providers are really great. But truth be told, now most students are actually hybrids. So we hear repeatedly stories of I'm taking four of my courses are brick and mortar. I'm on campus. I'm taking an online course from my dorm room at my own school because it just didn't fit into my schedule or whatever. This is a self-paced course, and I like that better. So it's evolving, but not quite to the degree that maybe Clayton Christensen was predicting 4 or 5 years ago with the disruption of higher ed. There's something about being at a university and having the credential from an established school also that students recognize as value.
Did you see the study on DeVry?
No, I haven't.
There was a study out of Stanford where they looked at thousands of students taking DeVry, which is a private institution, and they looked at people who were close enough to a brick-and-mortar school to go there but opted to take an online course. The ones who opted to take the online course did significantly worse than that course and subsequent courses. So there's a huge problem there. So what that magical interaction is, the high-touch interaction. Another thing, I wonder, given that if you look at the public health data
mm-hmm.
and given that in many cases students are actually human beings,
mm-hmm.
is there any way to integrate the two databases so that the actual health data is probably going to give you indicators of people who are in distress, but it's not going to be an academic solution. It's going to be a health-related solution. So just wondering.
The nightmarish combination of HIPAA and FERPA.
Yeah.
You could, but I think the lawyers would probably stop you right quick on being able to do that.
I understand that, but as somebody is getting to the age of reason, as we would say, right, and the amount of money that's going into it, I mean, looking towards wanting to guarantee success.
Yeah, all I can tell you is about current state right now.
Mm-hmm.
We integrate with a lot of different offices around campus. Most is a bi-directional data flow when it comes to things like shared notes. There's one big office which is unidirectional, and data only flows into anything health-facing. That being said, if you were to collect interesting information about a student's state, either mental or physical health, that is a potential reason why you wouldn't come back. And, in fact, there's been a great study on shocks that knock you out of higher ed and some of the sudden life events that occur, everything from I got a job that I wasn't expecting to I lost my scholarship. But there are some health things that show up in there, getting pregnant, that are shocks that we knock you out. So it'd be interesting to incorporate that. I just see too many legal challenges to be able to do it, at least anywhere in the near short term.
Yeah.
So I guess I was wondering, what is the role of financial aid? Because it feels like for ownership and accountability to take place, somebody needs to be hurting, and it feels like. Nobody's really hurting the students when they get out and have to pay that back, but they're not when they're in there. So it's hard for them to make those decisions, and those incentives aren't there, sort of the same way that health insurance or some of these the at-risk population, they're not feeling that that immediate incentive to.
I feel like financial aid is the great undiscovered country here.
It just feels like that would be the place where ownership and accountability really could be,
mm-hmm.
Implemented if they were to say, if you save us this much, defaulted student loans, you can get shared savings. There would be some incentive there.
So, interesting enough, there are some experiments in this right now. There are schools that are fooling around with the idea of the farther you progress, the cheaper it becomes.
Uh-huh.
So, essentially, you get a grant if you become a junior. And you get a bigger grant if you become a senior.
Uh-huh.
So, there's a little bit of kind of revenue sharing there, I suppose. And not how they would think about it, but a little bit of that kind of debrayed cost. More broadly speaking, there's a couple trends going on with financial aid that are really interesting, and I'll tie it back to what you're saying in a moment.
Okay.
But just to make you aware, so there are a lot of different kinds of financial aid students can get. I'm going to put merit-based aid completely away, because that's just, in a lot of times, a coupon to entice your enrollment, or a sports scholarship to entice your enrollment. But from a need-based standpoint, everybody's always made the assumption that we make you an offer early on, and that's what you need, and we update it when you refile your FAFSA year over year. But people haven't really thought strategically about how to deploy aid to keep students in school. There are some schools that are beginning to do this. One of the great examples is Georgia State. Georgia State has something called the Panther Retention Grants. These are alumni-funded micro-scholarships, and they deploy them to specific students who are kind of like last-minute problems, like just get you over the finish line. It's the best practice we've ever seen. It pays for itself, and because these students typically have unpaid balances, and you're actually reaping, much like striking a deal with the IRS, you're actually getting revenue out of the student. The alumni are engaged, the students are graduating, everybody loves it. People just haven't thought strategically about that because the enrollment managers haven't really been involved in the success story until the next couple of years. There is a piece of accountability out there that is going to push schools if it ever comes to be, and that's access to federal financial aid. So one of the things the Obama administration tried and failed to do was to tie access to favorable loan rates, federal loan rates, to your performance as an institution. If you're a good school, based on the metrics they lay out, your students get cheaper loans. If you're a bad school, your students get more expensive loans, and eventually you'll just go out of business.
Readmission rates in hospitals, you can share in our state. Like, if you,
That's what I was thinking with the care. Yeah, it's a totally different actor in that case, but I think what I'm trying to get at, larger speaking, there's big trends here that are only beginning to really be fully explored, because everybody kind of thought financial aid was just this, like, it's done, like, there's nothing to be done there. Let's just make Pell Grants bigger every couple of years, and then that's it. But there's actually some really great things that can be done, too.
But if you're tied to your performance, as an institution or as a student, there was...
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. I just thought, I don't have great examples, because those ideas are just beginning to come to light.
Sorry. Can I just interject? So we're slightly over time, although we started late. So mindful of everyone else's commitments, if you need to leave, feel free. You should take maybe one question from online after you
guys. The comment is the whole loan rate thing, there's more to that story than meets the eye, and it isn't always on the university side. So, best of my knowledge, $50 billion a year. So, when the banks got into trouble, the loans got managed by the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
$50 billion a year in interest goes to running the Department of Education.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so there's a cream off that sort of not in the federal government's best interest. But Congress will never give that money back to the Department of Education to use it. So that story is much more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
The other one, and it's something that goes on in smaller executive MBA programs that that are part-time.
Mm-hmm.
They register you in the 12th week of the semester for the next semester.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 14th week of the semester, they deliver the books to you.
Mm-hmm.
I know, because I've been in.
Mm-hmm.
But the point being is that reaffirms that you're going to show up in the next
term. It's the Cleveland State model of you're mentally defaulted into returning rather than
absolutely.
I have to make a choice about whether or not I'm going to come back. And for the same reason.
And they charge you for those books, obviously. But
now you're really locked in.
No, but that's a commitment on your part. But as an executive for whom time is absolutely critical, and you're taking this up in your spare time. Having somebody else show up with the books and the package and the notes, it probably saves you an hour.
Yeah.
Right? But it feels like a hell of a lot more.
It's a great service. Yeah,
that's just a friend.
I love any of these bridge things, and we've seen schools also begin to experiment with summer programs in a similar way. If I can pull you forward a little bit.
And for a lot of schools, the bookstore is actually not part of it. They get some
retainers. Oh, yeah,
but it's Barnes & Noble. I think it's something that they'd be happy to deliver a book. It means they're getting.
I'm going to have to look out for a school that's doing that.
It's fine if you want to give them the books and you're happy for them to pay halfway through the next semester. But if you want them to pay for it right then, you're hooked.
So that's a really, you bring up a point, which is whenever you're thinking about success, best practices, lots of good ideas seem like good ideas, but benefit the students who need it, not at all. So, you know, under your world, this would probably benefit the students who probably were going to come back anyway, because they were being, they had the ability to pay, and, you know, they're probably from a better off background anyway. They're going to graduate. Should we do one online question? And I'll hang out afterwards.
We should just ask, are there any questions?
Nobody likes me.
I can't. Comment and then a question. My home institution of Michigan State is doing a lot of this. Neighborhoods, so a very large public university.
I love Michigan State, yeah.
Setting up neighborhoods. A colleague of mine is coordinating it all, and the faculty, the actually the healthcare services, counseling, tutoring services, all bundled, but not only in a central location, in neighborhoods all around campus, so they're not far from where students live on whatever part of campus they are. The piece I know from my home institution, and I didn't hear you talk about as much, and I was interested in, is the role of the faculty. So I see a 3F faculty specialist, but in a way, listening to you, it sounds like the faculty are, in a way, being kind of bypassed and maybe saying they're just not that involved. I'm aware, at least at Michigan State, and I've been here for a year and a half, so I'm not really up to date on it, but there is a lot of effort to get some of the big data about who are high-risk students, in what courses, what the papers. I think they are trying to do some stuff about the students having cards that they have to use, like if they go to the health center, the tutoring center. So they're getting some data about health, too, and trying to get it to faculty members, particularly in first-year courses, so that the faculty can really, and there's quite a number of seminars happening where the faculty are interacting with people who are the support services for the students to try to get the faculty both kind of morally committed, but also very practically in terms of who's failing or not, are doing well on it.
Yeah, the faculty are a really interesting population here because they're obviously critical actors for a lot of this, both as advisors in a lot of cases, they're the ones actually interacting with students, as instructors also interacting with students, and as owners of their program's curriculum, which can be rigged against students' favor, actually, because these tend to just grow. Now, suddenly you have 132 credits to get your whatever degree, because usually engineering, but not always, because everybody just added their course to the required curriculum and they never took anything away. Finding the
good examples of
exactly the I've got a couple. So I'm going to put aside the whole program redesign angle because that's a whole other talk. Literally is a whole other talk that we have. But getting faculty members involved in stuff like this, I've got two in the use of data, two good examples. One comes from UMass Dartmouth, the school I already mentioned, where the chair of the psych department, I believe, was using actually our predictive model and said, look, I've got 7 faculty members in this department. I know everybody's abilities and their own interests in students. I also now know the relative risk of all my students. I'm going to take my lowest risk students and give them to the worst advisors. Because these people want to be mentors. They don't want to be advisors, right? Just come on in. I'll chat with you a little bit about how cool psychology is and some things you might be able to do when you graduate and take this class. The higher risk students, I'll give them to the ones that are known to be better advisors. I'll actually do some caregiving here. And the highest risk cases are mine because I'm going to lead that way. And then I've got a whole other faculty member, which I'm keeping completely out of this, and you just get to analyze the data. So it was a bit of divisional labor. There's another example we have of divisional labor, which is what I studied in grad school, by the way, so I like look at that a lot. But the University of Northern Colorado's biology department has 20 faculty members, and they all have to do some advising. They got lots of students because they're a bio department. They found that they only had 5 or 6 faculty members that really wanted to do anything to do with advising or had any kind of skill in it. So they said, okay, you other 15, you're just going to be the sophomore, or sorry, you're going to be junior and senior. All your students are juniors and seniors, and you're going to do the mentoring stuff that you want to do. And meet with them once a year and or once a term and get them their PIN and let them register, and that's great. The 5 of us are going to focus on the first 2 years. Now, it's too many students for us to handle through normal means, so we're going to rig up something a little bit different. What we're going to do is offer 5 group advising sessions, 35 students each time, and all 5 of us faculty members will be here. We're going to use beforehand all of our analytic tools to go through and look at the 35 students that are coming in and we're going to carve off the ones that need extra help. So we're going to do the group advising session. These are all the things you need to know. Then we're going to meet with each student afterwards for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, or whatever it might be, to have a little customized conversation. All the students that need extra help are at the back of that line because they're going to need 10, 15, or 20 minutes of our time, and we're each going to take on one or two of these folks. So they've been able to do the Pop Health model without even trying by essentially starving the students who need it the least and feeding the students who need it the most through this breakup system. They actually think it's working great. The larger meta story here is that not all faculty members are made alike. It's a highly heterogeneous population. The level of interest and attitudes towards this varies tremendously from person to person. So to treat the faculty as a monolithic block is a dumb idea, but a lot of administrators tend to feel that way. Instead, a better approach is work with the willing. Yeah, 80% of your faculty members want nothing to do with this. Don't talk to them about it. Talk to the 20% that are true believers and really in. They're probably on the younger side. They're probably more data enabled, and they're probably more likely to be teaching your first and second year courses where a lot of this can actually be in play.
Teaching relief or
there's yeah. So department to department, you hear stories of like, well, you don't have to teach four courses. You could teach three. Or another option, again from Middle Tennessee, is that they've used a lot of the analytic platform that we provide to identify the courses which were, remember the A, B, C curves that I showed? The courses with the steepest curves, which actually turned out to be 9 out of their 10 highest enrollment courses, so the Gen Ed. So they pulled those faculty members in and said, we have tons of students plowing through these courses. They also are the courses in which performance is most correlated with success. So we have 5,000 courses at the school, but we only care about 9 today. And they gave each of these faculty members, I think it was like a $10,000 or $20,000 course redesign grant, and said, just have at it, like, make your course better. And we don't know if this is causative or just correlative, but certainly isn't going to hurt to have a better course for our Gen Eds. I mean, at the very worst, we're going to have a better first-year experience. But that's a way to, again, work with willing faculty members in a, on an avenue that they want, which is, yeah, we'd love to have a better course. And certainly we'd love to have the money to go do that instead of having to, you know, just scrape this together on my own. And we don't know how that's going to play out, but it certainly doesn't seem like a bad idea. And it's relatively inexpensive. Anyway. Yeah, you haven't said anything.
It just, I was curious, it seems like finding a new issue to connect here, and the other one seems to be like mental health of the students. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's any way with people or whatever that you can analyze or maybe you already have just like counseling appointments or, you know, or something like that.
Yeah. The records are pretty locked.
Yeah, that's probably locked. Or what about like recommendations from the academic advisor to a counselor or something.
Yeah, it's an area that people are super uncomfortable with us going too far into because of the privacy issues, but I wonder if there's something to do there. There are schools that have identified mental health as being their number one issue. I won't name them by names, but they tend to be great at everything else. They're top-performing schools, but for whatever reason, they're a real stressful environment, and they're worried about students cracking. And so this is what they want to monitor. They've made little progress in pre-identifying mental issues before they happen, but it's certainly something they're paying a lot of attention to. I will say it's a relatively smaller group of schools that consider this their top issue. Everybody else is more interested in finances, academic performance, but this is a multi-causal issue, and like it's all the things, right?
It's a huge issue, like people just playing video games in their dorm rooms instead of doing their homework.
Yeah. Well, now you get into a coaching situation, which is a little bit different. But yeah. It's all wrapped up in, like, I'll just tell you right now, like, we're trying to hit it with a lot of different sticks, essentially. This is going to be a long process to change anything. And the data really bears that out.
ASU introduced, they funded most private schools for some sort of, here's what it means from the college.
Mm-hmm.
So they introduced, but one credit course was required for every entering person.
Yeah.
And it just said to the dean, you got 10,000 students in your college.
Mm-hmm.
And they also required it to be less than 24 people.
Yeah. So little first year seminars. Yeah, most schools have those now.
But it was a, you know, they added, you know, it's 121 hours rather than 120, but then. Where the revolt was on campus was associated with the fact that it wasn't legal for the president's office to generate for you. So they generate the curriculum.
Yeah.
And then push it onto the system.
That's a very issue thing to do. There are some schools that are really leveraging those first year experience courses even further. So they're becoming, bridge courses for block curricula. So I've got a course here, a big one here, and an intro to bio, intro to psych, and I'm going to create a neurology course, which is a small group. Same 20 students are in the big 30-person or 300-person lecture over here and the big 300-person lecture over here, but they're all in this little bridge course. So I get this learning community built out of this, relatively inexpensive, plus I can teach a small neurology course, which I'll come back to memory or something like that. Other schools are leveraging that where your first year academic advisor is your instructor for that first year experience course. And so it creates a little bit more of a, this person's here to help you. But yeah, a lot of schools have invested in it. They're pretty common now.
I just want to question about the data that you're collecting. Yeah. The presentation came up a little bit when you said students were calling other students.
Yeah.
And I was wondering,
how
can I never get a list of students and their labels already highly?
Oh, this is one of my favorite questions. Yeah. FERPA doesn't cover as much as everybody thinks it does, and if you are an agent of the institution, you have access to a lot of the information that you have about students. I don't know about the student call center, but something like not enrolled for the next term, I don't think is, that's not FERPA protected, as near as I can tell. Although I really want to check on that now. I don't think it is. But something like the student's grades would be. So you obviously wouldn't be able to share that with them. What they're more worried about with the student call center is students just going off the rails saying whatever on these phone calls. So what they've done is really, really tightly script them. They've got three sentences to say, essentially. Just like the person who's calling you to get you to fill out a like a political survey. They have to be, for methodology reasons, very tightly scripted, so they ask the same question each time. These students are the same way. And instead, they innovate more around, like, how are they actually going to get contact with that person? They're incented, by the way, with $250 gift cards to the student store, which is kind of a cool incentive, relatively inexpensive. Essentially, what percentage of students on your list did you actually get in touch with? So that's one of the privacy issues. The other one is just, like, would I be rigging? If I told a professor ahead of time, here's your 20 students, these four are red, these 10 are yellow, and the rest are green. How does that change behavior about how you teach the class? Huge concern. It's not an area we've actually gone much into from a like class roster standpoint, because you could also see the other side, which is, I know who I need to devote extra attention to. This is a question for the philosophers and the ethicists, for sure, but it's one of those places where you've really hit on like the intersection between potential huge benefit and huge folly. And I don't have an answer for that one, but I love the debate.
The only parallel I can think of is that if you can get the thing up for the letter saying you have accommodations, but you don't very involved
in the accommodations. Yeah.
And it's so indicating
that you have to do it. Yeah. There are a lot of, I think, behavioral information that is not also FERPA protected. Observational information, that's what I should say. I'm not a lawyer. I don't want to get into that. We're leaving on the not a lawyer question.
Yeah, so thank you again. That was fantastic. Okay.
Thanks, everyone.
Appreciate it.